I was more interested in writing about someone in a very complex moral position, forced to make impossible choices, really, than presenting someone who was a saint.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Welcome to Not That Kind of Rabbi. It's interesting, over the last little while, the rabbi at the synagogue I attend here in Hamilton was under the weather, had some issues. So I found myself doing Torah study in his place. He asked me to do it, and I was honored. And it was what a lot of people think are some of the least exciting parshas in the Torah, where really you're talking about the building of a tabernacle, the exact way clothing should be made for the high priest and the things that they should have as adornment. And you can sort of see it as, if you're an engineer, this is fun, but for the rest of us, what are we listening to here? But I managed to find things to pull out of it. One of the things that I pulled out was the eternal flame, the Ner Tamid, is actually the first thing they tell you that you have to have. And you haven't even built the tabernacle yet. You just have to have this flame that exists. That is, in our discussion about it in study, it was internal to us, that flame that goes on forever, but happens to reside in you for this mortal moment. And everything around you also containing that. But then I started to think about how we can become really engaged in these things and really decide that they're, you know, literal and important, and we're going to dig deep. And then they become the truth of everything. And that's how people end up in psychiatric wards in Israel with Jerusalem syndrome, because they believe that they have actually become the Messiah. They are, you can get nuts. So I bring all this up because there's a book. Now, by all accounts, a nonfiction reader. I even have a nonfiction book club with some friends of mine. So I almost never read fiction. But this book was sent to me, and I thought, okay. And it's called Fervor, and it's a novel by an author that I'm about to introduce to you called Toby Lloyd. And I loved it, because I got to immerse myself in two things that I've just spoken about a bit. The ability to believe and the danger of believing too much or too little in things and in life and in people. So I won't say much more because I want to explore this with this author. So let me introduce you to the author of Fervor. Out today, I might add, in fine Canadian bookstores, Toby Lloyd. How are you, Toby?
I'm good, thanks, Ralph. And I love that introduction. When people read the book, I think they'll see a lot of what the book is about was sort of contained in that little speech. So I love that.
So let's talk about it. Now, I don't want to start talking about, you know, narrative at this point. I want to sort of pull some essences out, like a good parsha. One of the things that intrigues me is, in the beginning, we're immersed in this world of a Holocaust survivor, a grandfather, a Zaidi, in an attic. Take me through what happens in that attic and who the players are and what they get out of that experience.
The book begins at a kind of moment of change in this family dynamic, which is the grandfather of the family is clearly dying, and everyone knows he's dying. What exactly is going to happen in terms of the power dynamics of the family when he dies aren't quite clear. So that's where the family is on kind of page one of the novel. And his three grandchildren are each sent up to see him, and with the idea that he might say his goodbyes to them. And of course, they're hoping that he's going to deliver them some kind of truth about life, because that's what we look for in grandfathers and grandmothers. And that's kind of the starting point of the novel. And I guess I was interested in the idea of what if the things that he says were kind of disappointing or maybe a little bit cryptic in some ways.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of Douglas Adams in A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and the answer is 42.
Right.
And you're like, that's it? 42? Okay, all right. I thought it would be more than that. But there's also the mother in the book, who really is, I'm not quite sure why she's so aggressively pursuing the story, pulling it out of this Zadie and how painful it is. It's like a surgery she's doing. What was the role that you wanted filled there? What was she doing for us?
She's a writer, she's a journalist, and she wants to get his story out of him of what happened to him during the war. He was born in Poland, bad time to be born as a Jew in the middle of the 20th century. And he doesn't really want to tell it. Why? Why is she so aggressive? Well, there's at least two answers to that question. One answer is her answer, which is that she thinks it's important to record these things before they sail off into oblivion with his death. And so she would say that what she's doing is moral work, important work, part of the ongoing effort to ensure never again. But there's another answer to that question, which is not the answer she would give, but the answer one of her critics might give, is that she is blinded by her own ambition, that she believes that writing this book is going to transform her from an ordinary journalist to the writer of some transcendent book about the Holocaust, and it's going to give her fame and it's going to give her recognition.
And there's also the idea of orthodoxy here. What role does orthodoxy, or did orthodoxy, play in you as a person?
I'm not a follower of religion. I wasn't brought up in an Orthodox household, but I find orthodoxy very interesting. And it comes back to where you started in terms of what kind of truth do we see in stories. And for the family that I've written about, some members of the family, including Hannah, take things literally that others might take as metaphorical or spiritual truths. And that gets her into, well, some interesting positions.
Yeah. I want to talk about Tovia. The more I'm hearing you and listening to you, I'm thinking he's kind of a little like you.
I hope not.
Well, I don't mean in the bad ways. I mean in the ability, like the intellectual ability and the recognition of a certain skepticism about what you see around you. You know, so tell me about that character and what part of you he is.
When you write characters, you purposefully or not impart bits of yourself into all of them, because in a sense, that's what empathy is trying to see yourself as another person. In terms of Tovia himself, he came from this idea of what would it be like to be staunchly atheist, for reasons he himself doesn't necessarily understand. It's a conviction he has from a very young age. He doesn't get talked into it by someone, but he is staunchly atheist. But to be brought up in a very religious family, and a family where not believing in God is not an option, and how that might, not necessarily warp, but mold his character over time.
He's also very, and this is the part that I don't think is like you so far, he's very socially dangerous. You don't know what he's going to say or who he's going to say it to and how many people he's going to offend in one particular evening. Is that a defense mechanism, or is it the pressure of this family that is crazy?
I think he is, like many very arrogant people, very insecure. That those two things are two sides of the same coin. And the kind of aggression comes out of that. It's both an assertion of the correctness of his own ideas. There's no need to pander to other people because I'm right about things, so I can be very socially aggressive. But also this sort of deep insecurity. This is not a happy person. This is not a well-socialized person. This is a person who sees threat everywhere.
I'm going to give people the Cole's notes on the book just at this moment. I'm talking to Toby Lloyd. His book is called Fervor. And somebody wrote, Fervor tells the story of a close-knit Jewish family in London, pushed to the brink when they suspect their daughter is a witch. Hannah and Eric are devout Jews living in North London with their three children and Eric's father, Yosef, a Holocaust survivor. Both intellectually gifted and deeply unconventional, the Rosenthals believe in the literal truth of the Old Testament and in the presence of God and evil in daily life. So that's kind of a little wrap for people so they can figure out what we're talking about. In reading the book, I really felt that, so you have one atheist, you have one literalist in Elsie, and then you have another son who's just not very sympathetic, I must say. Not too happy a dude, but he's sort of a truth teller as well. Everybody here in one way or another is a bit of a truth teller, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's the joke? Two Jews, three opinions. Something like that. There's something of that to the novel.
Yeah, and they kind of tear each other apart. There's this kind of a family cannibalism going on in this book. Everybody's on each other at one point, and then all of a sudden they're supportive and loving of each other. When you wrote this book, so this is your first novel. You've written for quite a while, but this is your first novel.
Correct.
What made you go, I have a story to tell and this is it? And how formed was it when you decided that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say that I didn't really know what I was doing as I bumbled towards a first draft, but I did know what I was doing when I was working towards my last draft. And I think that's a lot of writers' experience. The book came out of a few different places. I knew I wanted to channel some of the biblical reading I'd been doing. Part of the novel is sort of a retelling of Old Testament legend. And I knew I wanted to write something that sort of resembled a modern horror film. And somehow those two became the same thing. And then the characters sort of, I don't know, emerged organically. As I say, it was a big mess as I made my way towards that first draft. But then at a certain point, it seemed to all make sense together.
There's some sadness here when the story of what Zadie really was doing in concentration camps comes out. Talk to me a bit about that piece of what you were writing and where it came from.
It's desperately sad, as all everything the Holocaust touches is. It seems, you know, to especially to European Jews, an unignorable part of the recent past. It felt that it had to be in there somewhere. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but
what he does is not what we always think. Oh, this person's a victim of things and it's all horrible. He has to make some tough choices in there.
He does. So I was greatly inspired by Primo Levi, who's one of my absolute writing idols. And he talks about, in his book, The Drowned of the Saved, his last book, he talks about what he calls the gray zone. It's not true to say that there are no victims and there are no perpetrators. That's a very dangerous lie. There were victims and there were perpetrators. But there is also a spectrum of people who existed between those two poles, which is what Levy calls the gray zone. And thinking about what it would be like to make the sort of morally impossible decisions that, you know, for example, the Jewish leaderships in Amsterdam at the time, they were told, name a certain number of Jews to be sent off to camps. And they had to make the decision, do we give the names or do we refuse to collaborate? Will the reprisals for refusing be worse? And it's relatively easy with hindsight to say, well, what could have been worse than going along? What could have been worse? Any sort of resistance must have been better. But would that have been obvious in, you know, 1940 and 1941? It's very difficult, I think, for us where we are today to know that. And so I was more interested in writing about someone in a very complex moral position, forced to make impossible choices, really, than presenting someone who was a saint or someone who was just very simply a victim.
What do you want people to get from the book? Because there's a lot going on and there's a lot of complex characters in this book. But what is it you're hoping that when I go to the last page, I walk away with?
You know, that's not something I've really thought about. I thought about how to write the book and what I wanted the book to kind of be. I guess what I would want people to feel is energized, provoked, excited, and ultimately moved. You know, the work of art, I think, is to make us feel an emotional response to events that are illusory.
What do you think of if somebody asked you, oh, I read your book, it felt very Jewish to me. What would you, if somebody identifies you as very Jewish, what's your reaction?
I guess a mixture of pride and indignation. Pride, because all my favorite writers are Jewish. I mean, not all of them, but so many of them. And I had this experience once. I was buying a book from a secondhand bookseller, and I was buying a John Updike book, right? Not a Jew. And the bookseller says to me, I never liked John Updike. And I said, okay, I still want to buy the book. And he said, and I don't like Philip Roth either. Too Jewish. And I'm not sure how we got from me buying an Updike book to Philip Roth too Jewish, but we did. And I love Philip Roth. And so I would, yes, I would feel it pride to be in a lineage that is a lineage that I have a lot of affection for it. But I would be indignant on the idea of why the category? Why is Philip Roth a great Jewish writer rather than just a great writer? You know, why is my book so Jewish rather than so, I don't know, can't tell you what adjective to give to it, but you know, all the adjectives you could give to a book, why Jewish? Right.
But on the other hand, when you said John Updike, not Jewish, you know, that's a whole drinking game for people. Just like looking at a TV set and seeing, my father used to sit there and watch the TV and just every 15th person, he'd go, he's Jewish, you know? So there is an identity thing and an identification thing, I guess. So the next book, do you think, if you started thinking of it or halfway through it or whatever, will you find yourself veering away from a Jewish theme because you don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be Philip Roth too Jewish?
Well, Roth himself veered away from Jewish themes. He wrote a book called When She Was Good. It was about his fourth novel and no Jews in it. And it kind of tanked and he never repeated the experiment. the book that I'm planning is, it's not very Jewish, but so far no Jews in it, but that might change.
What did you learn? What did you learn doing this book?
I learned an awful lot. I did a lot of research. I learned a lot about Kabbalah and I learned a fair amount about the Second World War. And in terms of writing it, I guess I learned the big writing lesson for me was to just not be afraid. And I feel like I took a lot of risks with this book. and there are a lot of things in it that people might object to or, I don't know, might not get along with. And that's fine.
Well, listen, I really enjoyed the book. I hope it gains a wide audience. And I look forward to the next book. And we'll see if my father's, he's a Jew game, can go to the wayside, and we'll do a whole other story in there. The book is called Fervor. The author is Toby Lloyd, and it is available as of this moment here in this fine country called Canada. Toby, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ralph. Lovely to chat.
Thanks for listening to Not That Kind of Rabbi. If you enjoyed your time with us, we'd love for you to subscribe to this show wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Ralph Ben-Murgi. Our show is produced and edited by Michael Freeman. We're part of the CJN Podcast Network. And to support our work with a tax-deductible donation, all you have to do is visit thecjn.ca/donate. Take care of each other. Bye.